You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 25 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Pesetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Remember that you can follow us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast and swing by our Facebook page, facebook.com/Social Media and Politics Podcast. And speaking of that Facebook page, we are here in studio at Lund University's Humlab.
Larm Studio, I think is the official name.
And the voice you hear is that of Dr. Anna Maria Ducek-Segestin, who is the vice chair
of the Center for European Studies and lecturer in European Studies at Lund University.
And friend of the pod. So we've actually just done a Facebook live stream on the UK general elections, which we'll be talking about in this episode. So swing by and check that out. We're coming directly from there. So we'll see how this this podcast goes. And that was more about what are the implications of the latest British general election. Why don't you give us a little bit of an introduction into what just happened in the UK?
Well, today is June 9th, and yesterday was the day of the snap elections called very recently by the current Prime Minister, Theresa May, representing the Conservative Party, in an attempt to consolidate her mandate to negotiate the Brexit agreement with the European Union. However, and this is the very interesting part, it did not turn out as planned for Theresa May and her party, because instead of winning a more stable majority, the Tories managed to actually lose mandates in a very tightly fought electoral campaign against the Labour Party.
Right. And so the next general election for the UK wasn't planned until 2020. But she came out on, I think it was May 8th or maybe it was a bit
earlier. A month ago, pretty much.
And came out and said, we're going to hold a snap election. It essentially was an attempt to better her position. And a lot of the commentators were saying, you know, how much will they win by? That was the question. They were projected to win. And within the past week or two, there was a more narrowing in the polls with the center-left Labour Party. And yeah, it turned out that her call to consolidate power actually backfired. They lost seats. Labour gained seats. And also the SNP lost some seats, which we can talk about.
It was a mixed bag in terms of the results. We can definitely comment on the mandate tally, who lost, who won. But I think it's also interesting to put it into the perspective of what we normally talk about, which is campaigning and social media,
right,
and this type of stuff that I'm looking forward to discuss.
Yes. So if you want to hear more about the outcome of the elections, what that means for the Brexit negotiations, go ahead and check out the live stream. It's pinned up on the Social Media and Politics Podcast Facebook page. But here we're going to be talking more about the social media side, obviously.
Unsurprisingly, exactly.
And I'd mentioned we did a year in review episode for 2016, where we kind of alluded to some of our research. But one of the recent studies we published has to deal with the 2015 British elections and how citizens use Twitter. So we'll get into that a bit in this episode. We'll talk about some of the promotional ads that the campaigns are running on Facebook. We'll talk about the Twitter activity and essentially what was going on in the UK on social media around this snap election, which was kind of called again unexpectedly by Theresa May and largely backfired on her and her party. So should we just pick up with 2017 and then work our way back?
Yeah, I'm curious. Or? I mean, I think in order to make sense of it all, I think we should talk a little bit about the results and why this is such an upsetting, you know, literal meaning of the word result. And basically, the sum up of things is that the Tory party, instead of winning an extra 20 mandates, which was the projected expectation at the beginning of the campaign, actually lost 12 seats in the Westminster Parliament. The winner of the entire campaign was the Labour Party that increased their representation with 31 mandates and to some extent the Liberal Democrats that gained 3 mandates, even though this score is far below the expectations of the Lib Dems, who are the only staunchly pro-European and the ones who were hoping to gather all the Remainers vote. On the losing side, we can also count the Scottish National Party that lost 19 of their seats, and we we can also see that there's a little bit of a winner in Northern Ireland, the Democratic Union Party, that gained 10 seats and will be part of a governmental agreement with Theresa May's Tories.
Right. So to put this in perspective for our American listeners, in the UK, you have a first-past-the-post system, meaning it's winner-take-all, kind of like we have with the Electoral College. But this is actually broken down by constituency or by district. And what happens is if neither party or if any party doesn't get an absolute majority, meaning that they take most of the seats across the country, then they have to start brokering deals. And that's what's called forming a coalition. And so actually what happened in this election is the Conservatives had a majority. They called an election that backfired and they lost their majority. They're about 7 or 8 seats shy of being able to form a government. And this is where the Democratic Unionist Party comes in. Who's a small party well, they're a big party in Northern Ireland, but a small party in the UK. And now the Conservatives need to find a partner in order to form a government. And luckily for them, DUP had gained 2 seats to have 10 seats in total. And now they can start talking about
which are the required seats in order to have a weak majority. British Parliament has 650 members, and you would need to have one more than half in order to have a proper parliament. Because the results of the elections are so poor for the Tories, we will have what is known as a hung parliament, which means that they will need to cooperate with other parties to make their policies through.
And then you have a pretty insignificant party on the national stage. The DUP is now in a major brokering position in terms of gaining some concessions in terms of their policy measures from the Conservatives. So interesting times. We're recording on the day after the election results, so still a lot of uncertainty as to what's moving forward. But this election was very interesting in terms of how both the mass media and social media took it up on their own terms.
I think polarization was one of the key words that also popped up in many of the commentaries before the election. And to some extent, we cannot avoid it. We have to accept it. Polarization describes the at least print media landscape in the UK.
Which is worth noting that the British media market is a very tabloid-focused, sensationalist type of reporting. So you have newspapers like The Sun, The Express, The Daily Mail, very tabloid, a lot of pictures. And what's interesting is that they're very openly partisan in terms of which candidates they support and do not support. And unfortunately for the Labour Party, most print newspapers in the UK, most media organizations are pro-conservative because they're owned by Rupert Murdoch.
And that led in this concrete campaign to a very negative campaign against Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, who was portrayed as a red demon, as somebody who would take Britain into a coalition of chaos, to put a famous quote up here, somebody who is unfit to rule, a former Marxist, a radical communist, and all sorts of exaggerated rumors were spread about Corbyn trying to undermine his politician stature and to discredit his capabilities to lead the Labour Party or, more importantly, the country towards some successful story.
And I think this is where we can start kicking off with the social media aspect, because as I mentioned, the Conservatives were expected to win this in a landslide. And the question was how much, how many seats they would improve on. And what happened is that within the past 2 weeks of the election, the polls started getting more narrow. And that's when the media really picked up their aggressive campaign against Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. You know, I think the night before the election, there was a Corbyn with him in the trash can like Oscar the Grouch, right? And what was interesting about that is the Twitter sphere went pretty active on a hashtag called hashtag last minute Corbyn smears, where users would make hyperbole or sort of exaggerate calling out the media. And so looking at some examples here, Jeremy Corbyn once ran through a wheat field with absolutely no regard for the consequences of his action. So sort of just ridiculous examples, but calling out the media through this hashtag. And it really was reported in the mainstream media as well.
I think this is a very interesting aspect, looking at Twitter and Twitter mobilization from a labor constituency. And I think research at the Oxford Internet Institute supports this idea that labor took social media very seriously. They invested a lot of money, but also mobilized a lot of their base, a lot of their citizen affiliates. And that resulted in a dominance of Labor Party hashtags in tweets related to the election. According to this researcher that I'm referring to from the OII, almost 40% of party-specific tweets are dominated by pro-labor hashtags like Vote Labor, unsurprisingly, or Yes, We Can, a play on the Obama winning slogan in the U.S. In contrast, the Conservative Party hashtags only account for 26% of the total, and the other parties are not very much present, the SNP with the exception being 19%. So Labour Party hashtags seem to be very much present, including the ones citizen-generated, like the ones you were talking about. And that means that Labour used Twitter as one of their campaigning sites.
And I think Labour has traditionally been a better adopter of social media than the Conservatives, also in 2015. But I was looking at the Instagram accounts of the different parties, and Labour has been on Instagram since 2011 or 2013, whereas, interestingly, both Theresa May and the Conservatives started an Instagram account on May 8th. So clearly,
May 8th?
Which was very shortly after the election was announced. In looking at the content of those posts, which since it was only about a month ago, I think there's maybe 15, 20 posts they've made. Very scripted, very professional. Infographics, for example, and there's a lot of the same posts across
typical,
the two pages.
Typical of what we see also in other situations.
So if you remember from the World Leaders on Instagram episode, from that study, one third of the World Leaders Instagram accounts were only active during a campaign. So clearly, the Conservatives utilized Instagram for campaigning, probably not very effectively, compared to Labour, which has a much larger following, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50,000 users. I have to double check on the Conservatives, but they clearly just started their Instagram for this campaign and very professional, scripted. And I think what we've been hearing through this podcast series is that authenticity is the name of the game. Authenticity is what people on social media want to see. And I think Labour...
Were they on Snapchat, apropos authenticity? Because I think Instagram sometimes loans itself quite nicely to the more filtered, the more manicured, if you want, pictures, whereas Snapchat... at least my perception, and apparently others too, is that it's more authentic, more off the cuff, more improvised, the real deal. Do they have any Snapchat campaigning? Was there any?
So I looked, and you know, I think it's interesting because we were just in the States for a conference, and Snapchat released an update where you can search kind of like a keyword, and you would be able to access all different types of stories. Mm-hmm. But I think actually now that we're back in Europe, we don't have that feature because I tried to look for general election. I tried to look. It's also something that the digital campaigners in the past two episodes were talking about, which is it's difficult if you're a citizen to actually identify the Snapchat handle of a person you're trying to follow. So I was just sitting typing in, you know, Corbyn, Labour. Interestingly, the Labour that I picked up was from Ireland, so they don't have a monopoly on that handle. But Jeremy Corbyn was on Snapchat. He Snapchatted almost exclusively. You know, he was on the campaign trail, but on the election day, he snapped only about celebrities endorsing him. So they were uploaded videos from MIA, from different celebrities in the
that
UK.
Also participated in many of the events Labour organized. There were many free concerts. There was a lot of celebrity support. And that is interestingly poured into Snapchat. But there was no original to Snapchat content, because that's an interesting thing, again, on the podcast in previous episodes, that Snapchat asks the user to film or take pictures in app rather than import filmed videos from other apps. And you're saying that this was not the case in the Corbyn campaign.
No, the Corbyn campaign was uploading videos that celebrities had sent to them, which is a feature not available in the U.S. election, but has been updated since. So you can tell when it is like edit, you know,
yes,
brought in from camera roll. But what's interesting about it, just to mention that the Labour strategy of using celebrities was evident across all platforms. And they even said this was part of their strategy, which typically leans towards the left. The left parties,
yes,
not in the, just in the UK, but elsewhere, try to use this strategy. And what's interesting, though, is while the conservatives were not on Snapchat in terms of stories that I could find anyways. They were advertising, basically purchasing ad buys to be inserted in other people's stories, which from our last episode we know is a CPA ad, a cost per action that is a way to harvest emails, which brings us to the whole concept of micro-targeting that we'll get into
later, sure. Yeah. Okay, so Snapchat was used in the UK G2017 with some updates from the US elections. That's also interesting. Instagram was not used so heavily from what you have seen. I have mostly looked at Twitter. This is the data that I'm mostly contemplating and commenting on for this particular episode. And again, I think it's much, much of a political battleground. Right? Hashtag wars, one of the things that Michael and I obviously have been writing about, seem to be also in place with the vote Labour and vote Conservative fighting each other off, a decline of the SNP, and also a clear mobilization of constituencies, in particular Labour's, again, people, citizens, regular people's accounts simply retweeting, spreading through their personal networks the message of the party. So a lot of the engagement with the hashtags related to the parties, in particular, again, with Labour, was not to comment so much, not to mention so much, but to retweet, to spread the message to as many people as possible. And this is a consistent activity. That was the advantage of Labour, because they had a lot of followers, maybe not with a lot of followers themselves, but many, many individuals, private people, citizens who were reached by their Twitter hashtags and were very willing to share that on and on and on throughout the campaign.
Now, it's important to remember that when we look at Europe as a whole, Twitter is not a dominant medium, but in the UK, it is fairly popular. So just looking at some stats that I read, about a half of the UK population is on Facebook actively. So
on Facebook,
however they define that criteria, probably once a day. Now, only a quarter of the UK is on Twitter. And apparently the average time someone spends on Twitter in the UK is less than 1 minute per day.
Oh, so, the exposure. So the someone, exposure is minimal. Right?
Someone logs in probably from some gamification or notification, but doesn't say on it. But these Labour supporters, clearly active, clearly mobile.
If you spend that 1 minute on Twitter and are basically getting inundated with Labour messages, then that job is done, right? So you have to use that minute wisely. And I think this is what they have attempted to do. The leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has also a Twitter handle, and it has been used, maybe not so very much, but it has been used constantly. And the only other leader that could compare is, of course, the Prime Minister, Theresa May. Also, towards the end of the campaign, the name of Boris Johnson appeared. But most of the time, it is Corbyn and May that really rallied a lot of attention on Twitter. And that goes even if we include the Scottish, more regional candidates.
Yeah, and there's, to bring in another aspect of social media that I think is interesting was, and I think something that negatively impacted Theresa May, is that she was not willing to participate in the party leaders' debate between all of the heads of parties.
Is that a departure from the tradition in the UK, or is it normal that leaders don't talk to each other?
Well, it's actually quite interesting that the first televised debates during an election were only in 2010. And that was between Gordon Brown, David Cameron, and Nick Clegg, where Nick Clegg was a relatively obscure politician leading the Liberal Democrats. And that television appearance was very crucial for him to establish his message of honest and sincere politics. He came across as more casual. So fast forward to 2017, Theresa May would not participate in the debates. Jeremy Corbyn was very quick to pick up on this and continue that throughout the campaign. There were two instances, at least, where Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May faced off, and also something that happened in 2015, they would take questions from the public. So first, Jeremy Corbyn would go, take 45 minutes of questions on TV, and then Theresa May would come out after, or vice versa. Now, the interesting part where social media comes in, aside from the commentary during the debates, is that Theresa May, early in the election on May 15th, held a Facebook live stream where she basically argued that it's more important to take questions from the people, not directly from politicians. And what's funny about that live stream, first of all, it was perceived terribly by the public and the media. But Jeremy Corbyn actually came in and asked a question, kind of trolled her at the end of the live stream, asking, why won't you debate me flat out? And she gave this answer of...
Yeah, what is the reason? Why did she choose not to debate live? What was her justification?
The funny part was she said she was too busy thinking about Brexit negotiations, which is also a similar excuse to a 2014 debate where David Cameron and Ed Miliband said they wouldn't participate because they were too busy running the country.
So who else participated then in the 2015? If Cameron and Miliband were not part of the discussion.
This is in 2014.
14.
This was that European debate. So a lot of elections recently
in the UK.
This was for the European Parliament elections, that specific instance. But I believe in 2015, everyone participated. But in 2017, all the other party heads were there except for Nicola Sturgeon, who did participate in the Scottish debates, and the Conservatives, where Theresa May sent a surrogate whose name was
Amber Rudd.
Amber Rudd, and she just got torn apart for why is Theresa May not here? Which is funny, she would say that she's running the Brexit negotiations when this is precisely what she should be doing, is campaigning to get a better hand at the Brexit negotiations.
In a sense, I think it was perceived as a snub to the British public, saying that I'm too busy doing my job as a prime minister than to interact and hear your woos or take your matters close to my heart. And I think this is the image that she has projected, either willingly or unwillingly, a very intent politician, very determined to proceed with negotiations, very intent on managing stuff, but not very close to the people, not a true representative, not a very charismatic leader. And it seems that she has been punished for this type of persona that she has projected. I've been reading speculatively another reason why she decided to not take the Corbyn call for a meeting face-to-face, namely that she's very uncomfortable in face-to-face interactions. She's not very good to take questions off the cuff and give relaxed and spontaneous, authentic, if you want, responses. But she's more comfortable in prepared speeches, memorized slogans, and this kind of things. She's not a very good spontaneous person, and that would be probably even more disastrous for her to take on Corbyn, who is a very charismatic and very easy to talk to kind of person. Basically, that would undermine her credibility even further. So that's one of the other more strategic, if you want, reasons why she declined the invitation to participate, even though obviously it was a perceived cost. So,
and I think it relates back to their Instagram, the Conservative and Theresa May's, where it was very much prepared speeches. And I remember I looked at some of the comments in one of the videos. I mean, she does look very awkward. There's no doubt about that. And the comments are just filled with, what is she doing with her hands? Why is she so unnatural? And these are exactly the type of things you don't want to happen in front of the national public.
Double screening should not be about commenting about the persons, but about the content, maybe even making fun, but about the content, not about the person. And that would definitely undermine the purpose. So I think it was, in a sense, a clever decision, but inevitably it backfired because of this lack of charisma that she did not project. But in terms of what the message was, right? Her message, what was the Tory message? I always give a
strong and stable leadership,
which also sounds very repetitive with the S and very unattractive. It seems like more of the same. We're in charge. Doesn't seem to project that, at least doesn't match the way that Theresa May behaved. Whereas the Labour key message was for the many, not the few. I think this is the embodiment of a lot of social democratic left-wing thinking, redistribution approach, welfare state.
Stronger together.
This kind of like portraying the Tories as the privileged few. And they are the other, whereas the regular people should be the ones sharing the benefits of, say, economic prosperity. And that's what the agenda, the manifesto of the Labour Party was all about, scrapping tuition fees, more money, all the money that the NHS needs, something along those lines, which is kind of a vague promise, but it's a campaign promise nevertheless. More money for taking care of the retired people. A lot of welfare promises. And again, from a Scandinavian point of view, we are in Sweden. This doesn't seem like an immense revolution, but if you contrast it to the Tory message, this really comes to the opposite. So we can definitely see that in this election, The British people were definitely facing two very clear alternatives: the welfare in welfare program of the Labour Party and this kind of reduced government that Theresa May campaigned for. And she got a lot of flack for it. The dementia tax, which again is something that most people have heard about in the campaign, it was something that backfired on her immediately, because under this label, which was also a very popular hashtag on Twitter, there were a lot of measures meant to increase the self-pay portion of the healthcare plan in Britain. And that would definitely be a very negative news for a lot of the patients, especially with dementia, the number one cause of death in the country. So definitely that was a very weak point that the Labour used in order to attack the Tory message, and something that definitely demonstrated the willingness of people to believe in this left-wing message. And just on this point, this idea of getting rid of the tuition fees mobilized a lot of the young vote. In an opinion poll made before the actual election, 63% of the youngsters, 18 to 25, were supporters of the Corbyn line, and only 27 supporters of the May line. So clearly this idea of tuition, free education, was a message that young people really wanted to hear, and Corbyn delivered that.
Yeah. And as we were saying, that was, you know, younger people are typically on social media more. I really don't know how much that applies to Twitter. I would actually argue that the Twitter demographic is skewed a bit older. But Labour was the dominant party on social media. They had the most message. But I want to go back to 2015, where we did a study looking at citizens and how they were tweeting in the 2015 general elections. And maybe Labour as a party was the most active, but in terms of the citizens, it was actually the UK Independence Party, which is a nationalist populist party that was very key in promoting the vote leave message in the campaign. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that study?
That's an interesting contrast, perhaps, to make between the 2015 and 2017 elections. In our study regarding the general election 2 years ago, we found that these citizens that were supporting nationalist parties, the UKIP and the Scottish National Party, were the most active in promoting their message, in targeting other voters, in using strategic retweeting of each other's message, in promoting hashtag wars, getting them worked up in the online universe. And in contrast to that situation, in 2017, the UKIP basically is gone, disappeared. They had one member of the parliament, and that person is not reelected. And the overall share of the votes is so low. I don't even, maybe 4%. Let me not be quoted officially on that, but definitely very, very, very low. So we basically have seen the disintegration of the UKIP as a party and the disintegration of their citizen base. Once Brexit was a fact, once the Article 50 was triggered, there was no reason for UKIP to exist. The UK independence was achieved. And so it's pretty predictable that they should disappear. Interestingly, the Scottish National Party, which was the other very strongly present party on in our study in 2015, continued to be quite dominant. They had about 20% of the overall tweets, but that did not translate in as many votes. So again, one should definitely be relatively careful in using social media, and in particular Twitter, as some form of predictor for the final election results. I know there are several podcast episodes that bring this in, and I'm not sure if what I'm saying fits or not with what your other guests were saying. But I think looking at the popularity of hashtags and the popularity of leaders and the presence simply online, you would think that the SNP would fare better than what they have actually achieved.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that, just to break that study down a bit more, is that what we did is we took the top 100 most retweeted users in the week leading up to the election, and we found that about one third of them were citizens, and about 7% of that was public personalities and celebrities. But what's interesting about it is that really the top five users were tweeting about 800 times in 1 week. And so this brings us to the question of bots.
Yes.
And we were very curious as to whether these users were bots, you know, maybe programmed by the party or programmed by activists or who knows, foreign governments. So what we did was we actually direct messaged them on Twitter. And it turns out that these are real people. And they would strategically retweet manually in order to not be detected by Twitter as a bot. So they were aware of that filtering mechanism. And you know, I don't know whether they actually programmed to have help, but I think there are websites where you can do a feature called recurring tweets, where one of our top active users basically said when he goes on vacation, he sets an like a Hootsuit type of
algorithm,
yeah, that would just spam out tweets. So it isn't necessarily that these were automated bots, but they were humans as well.
And this is where the definition of bots is slightly controversial. There are some people who define it in strict automated terms, namely accounts that are robot-run, for example, retweeting certain hashtags or following and unfollowing on a certain algorithmic principle. But there are other people, other researchers, who define bots as real users who enhance their behavior through the strategic use of algorithms and other automation processes. So according to the definition we embraced in the article, these were real people. But according to this other definition, they'll be real people mixed with bots. So they'll be like, what do you call it? Androids.
Cyborgs.
Cyborg is the word.
Replicas,
right?
Whatever you want to call
yeah,
them.
Yeah, my God, that film is coming up soon, right? So anyway, so the idea is that that they were strategic in their use of technology. And I think this is a very important aspect that we have uncovered in our own work, and that people at the Oxford Internet Institute, again, have also a dedicated research team working with this topic. This idea that you have to be aware of the digital architecture, the features that Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Snapchat, and who knows what social media platforms of the future provide you, so that you can enhance your presence, your reach through the tweaking of those specificities. And this happens definitely on Twitter through the feature of recurring tweets. Apparently, again, just because I have some numbers in front of me, one in eight tweets, so about 12.3% of tweets related to UK politics are generated by bots.
Yeah, and this is a number, at least 10%. I think Twitter, in 2015, they stated that it was something like 14% of their overall sphere is bots.
So it's kind of constant between 2015 and 2017.
But there's an interesting aspect also that we uncovered, which was particularly, as you said, it was the UKIP supporters and the Scottish National Party supporters who were the most active, but there were also a few who were against the Scottish National Party. And particularly, there was one account called SNP Out. And when we messaged that, so the interesting thing about this account is that it looked very professional. So it wasn't branding itself as a person, but as an organization. So it had something like a big bullseye.
A logo.
Yeah, it had a logo. And so appeared as if it was some, you know, collaboration of citizens or something. And when we started talking to that person, it was a single person living in Scotland who was very much against the SNP and basically told me that she used her iPad to generate some graphics that she threw up there and essentially branded herself as this SNP out.
Anti-SNP supporter.
Promoting the hashtag SNP out. And that was the person who was also very aware of being flagged as a bot and manually retweeting. So it's interesting that it goes to this point of anonymity, and that, you know, you don't necessarily know who's behind these accounts. We also saw it with a account Frack Free MPs.
Yes.
So something that was against fracking, who demanded money before she would speak to me over Twitter. But the idea that you can be a citizen, but brand yourself as an organization, start a hashtag, get it trending, I think is quite interesting.
It's a channel simply that I think can be used for increasing democratic affordances, right? Citizens can use this to improve their voice or to increase the reach of their voice. And of course, like any tool, it can be also used for normatively bad purposes, right? So it can go either way. But I think in this election in 2017, we have seen much more of a professionalized Twitter use. I think we have parties, citizens have learned how to use this tool, how to manipulate it, if you wish, to their advantage, how to promote hashtags, all the strategies that we have uncovered in our own mobilization study of the 2015. We can see them performing better in this 2017 election.
Which, by the way, is not just limited to Twitter, because we've also just done a study during the Brexit campaign looking at who was commenting on the mainstream media public pages and who was commenting on the campaign pages. And again, we find that the anti-immigrant UKIP wing of the Leave campaign was by far, again, the most active in terms of both posting and in terms of generating comments. So there's this idea, we've talked about this also, that it's the social media activity seems to be driven a lot by being in opposition or not being in charge, that citizens feel mobile. I think there's some literature on this calling them insurgent campaigns, where if you're behind, if you're promoting a cause that's not the popular
that's not in power,
then you're more incentivized, I guess, to go on Twitter and use that.
I think social media is perceived as an alternative, basically. I think, as we were talking before about the polarized media climate in the UK, Twitter in particular, but I'm sure also Facebook, I guess we can talk about other social media. Twitter has been used as this alternative channel to reach out and find maybe even communities of like-minded, maybe left-wing oriented supporters, because there was such a blockade from the print media and partly also from the TV news sphere. Mm. So I think there is something to say to the extent that which social media is an alternative path that a lot of oppositional forces seem to take much more than governmental forces.
Mm. And, you know, we've been talking a lot, and also in our research, we've been very focused on the citizens and how they can amplify the message. And there's also been some studies out confirming this with the Bernie Sanders campaign, that supporters were sent messages directly to their phone saying, "We're posting now, like, comment, share." And this had a huge effect in terms of gaming the Facebook algorithm or gaming the Twitter algorithm to be a trending hashtag. But I think, you know, as I mentioned, a quarter of the population is on Twitter. Some of our guests have been a little bit skeptical as to what the role of Twitter is, especially if you're advertising on the platform. But I think what is super interesting about this election is the role of campaigning on Facebook. I mean, Facebook is the king of advertising, and for good reason. That's where everyone is.
This is basically where you can play around as a campaign manager, as a strategy designer. You can play out this kind of clustering idea. I think micro-targeting is not so cool to say anymore because you don't target individuals anymore.
Right.
But you do target individuals that share something, and they tend to also geographically share a specific area, right? So I think this is what happened very successfully for Labour again in this campaign. Namely, they were able to create several types of messages that were delivered with the help of Facebook targeting to their constituencies that were mostly in need of hearing that. So they could select the specific demographics, young people. Young people would not see something about the dementia tax. They would see something about tuition fees and how Labour plans to get rid of them. However, if you were, for example, a person who inhabits a region with high unemployment, you would see something about the benefits that Labour is going to promise you to get you out of that situation. Mm-hmm. If you will be a retired person, even though they're not so active on Facebook, those would be fall in the retired person category. They would also get something about their pension or their healthcare. Mm-hmm. So that would be, that is why I believe the Facebook targeting is the preferred modus operandi of campaigns. And I think Labour dedicated quite a lot of money to customizing this particular strategy, investing in creating these different ads, because it does take quite a lot of effort to create customized ads. I think this is why not everybody is doing it all the time. It costs to produce these messages, to create videos or infographics or whatever.
To test them.
And then to design and time and geographically target them to that right constituency. I think it's quite of an investment. Do you have any numbers on the money invested in this?
So I do. And it's very interesting between the 2015 and 2017 campaigns. So overall, in 2015, digital advertising accounted for 23% of campaigns' budgets. But when you break that down by party, the Conservative Party spent £1.2 million on Facebook ads. Labour was only £160,000.
£100 to £1 million.
Yeah, roughly. So, and then the other parties were all under £100,000. But this year, Labour pledged that they would spend up to £1 million on Facebook advertising. And what's interesting about it, so they've caught up. I think this has by matching the technology of the Conservatives, I think that is part of the reason that they were so successful in this campaign. But what's interesting about it is, as researchers, for example, we cannot see these posts. These posts are not public. They're unpublished in terms of most people's feeds. So you actually have to be the individual that they're targeting.
Exactly. The right type of individual for that specific message.
And so in reading about this, I think the public has become aware of this now. And there is a...
Because they all listen to the podcast.
Because they all listen to the podcast. That's right. There has been a 19-year-old in the UK. I'm going to try to get him on the podcast. We'll see. He developed a Google browser extension that you essentially give anonymous data to Facebook, or sorry, to the extension that looks for these sponsored ads and is called Who Targets Me. So you can voluntarily sign up, and they shared some information with BuzzFeed. And I think what's interesting about these ads is these are the more aggressive ads. These are the more racy things that they might not say on their public page, but when they're targeting, they absolutely will. So there is a link. I tweeted about it. I'll tweet about it again, where they have some examples of some of the quote-unquote micro-targeted ads, and they're very much more aggressive towards Jeremy
Corbyn. Negative, right?
Very negative.
Negative ads. I remember reading something about that as well, that a lot of these targeting strategies are actually dissuasive rather than persuasive.
Yes, exactly. So it's not that they're trying to mobilize their supporters, but demobilize the others. So what you had was you had a lot of advertisements that were going to, so the conservatives would put out advertisements towards areas that were very pro-labor, but very also pro-Brexit. So they were trying to, and it's important to remember that the Labor Party previously was very much in doubt of Jeremy Corbyn. There was a very big split within the Labor Party that's probably
the left wing and the more center wing,
which has now been consolidated probably more towards the left now. Mm-hmm. So for the conservatives, attacking Jeremy Corbyn as a leader is very smart. What will happen to our country? We'll throw it in chaos. And these are the types of ads that were going out behind the scenes. And unless you're in that constituency, unless you're fitting that audience demographic that you've been pre-selected for based on your prior data and history, you're not going to get those messages. And therefore, this is where the digital campaigning is, and we can't see it. And this is very problematic for democracy, for campaign finance reform, regulators. They don't know how to track this.
Exactly.
Money.
Campaign finance. This is a big issue, in particular in Europe. And I don't know how to count UK, but I think for most extents and purposes, I think it's still a European country. And the type of laws they have are quite regulating when it comes to how much and where the money can go. And social media is kind of a borderless territory, no man's land, right? So how do you regulate that? How do you intervene so that that funds are allocated not disproportionately to, say, capital cities or to particular problematic areas? And how can you get a distribution of the message to all the people? All citizens are entitled to a quality information, not only the people that are in a particular constituency. So I think this is a democratic access type of question that needs to be taken up by decision makers.
And proponents of this, so in our last episode with Matthew Oskowski, who was working with the Trump campaign, when I pressed him about the ethics of this, he said that voters choose convenience over privacy almost all the time. So the argument being that you're giving the message that person wants to or needs essentially to make an informed vote, but you're right in that it's not being shared around the entire it's not public for everyone to see. So is that convenience or is that something else?
I'm not sure. I think I have maybe the European perspective. I think that there should be a transparency in this. There should be some form of regulation. You think of the radical case in which this negative campaigning is not, as I see here, calling Jeremy Corbyn nonsensical or dangerous, even though that's kind of borderline, but outright anti-Semitic or racist messages that basically escape the radar of any regulators. And that is against the law, right? So we should be very careful when allowing this no man's land to be completely without any kind of control.
Yeah. So it's funny that I was reading about this and then I received actually a targeted ad from the Danish People's Party as I was in Denmark. And this is a anti-immigration party in Denmark. And their ad was basically saying, let's kick out the asylum seekers. They cost too much. So this is something that I don't know why I was targeted for this because I'm an immigrant in Denmark. Maybe they're feeding on existing immigrants or legal immigrants yeah. versus asylum seekers. I mean, yeah, this is pretty racy stuff. But there was one thing I wanted to comment on, which is, again, the regulations are very difficult to figure out as to figure out how much campaigns are spending on these type of advertisements. But what's interesting is that in the UK, their existing finance laws for campaigns are you can spend, I think it's somewhere between 12 and 15,000 pounds on a local candidate per constituency. But when you're targeting that constituency from the national party, the cap rises to 19 million. So essentially, and I think Trump spent something like 70 million on his digital ads. So if you factor in the population with the UK being less than one third, 19 million is a huge cap to spend on digital advertising. So I'm sure they didn't spend that much. But in terms of the legal structure as it is now, you can run a massive campaign if you have the contributions to do it.
Yes, I think it's an interesting question. I think this particular campaign opens, as I said, these kind of further questions for other campaigns, as we'll be watching closely the German campaigns in September or the German elections that will be taking place in September and the campaign preceding those to see in which way Germany, which is far more of an interventionist and much more regulatory state, would look at social media campaigning and contrast it or learn, so to say, from the lesson of the British elections this June.
It's important to remember also that these promoted ads are directed at certain constituencies. So it's not just about the audience, but it's also about where can these ads be strategically deployed in order to maintain a seat or win a swing seat. And in this sense, both Britain and America's first past the post system is very conducive to this type of targeted advertising, where is more when you have more parliamentary
proportional representation
systems, then either they have to fund a lot more because they can't, you know,
there's just too many things to target.
You have to target the entire nation. So in that sense, both the UK and the US are very interesting cases to look at this because their electoral systems are very ripe for this type of promoted ads.
Yeah, I also think about these demographics. I want to go back to this. And I'm curious what you were saying before about the young people being typically social media savvy and so on, and that it's to them that these targeted ads are, you know, designed. Do you think this is the case? I mean, I was bringing up this example of retired people who are on Facebook. There are some retired people on Facebook. Everybody's on Facebook. Every grandmother is on Facebook. They are also targeted. So I don't think this idea of the young demographics being the being captured by online campaigning is true.
No, I think in that sense, it's the older population who's more susceptible to these ads because they're not looking for the very small, lightly grayed sponsored content filter. Now, it depends on who the campaign's demographic is. Based on their polling, if it's the younger vote that they need, they're going to target them.
And Labour knew that. So maybe that reflects their increasing spending on the social media part.
But I think it also brings into question this idea of the dark or hidden social networks, where if you're targeting younger voters on Facebook, are they even on Facebook? I mean, 18-year-olds in the UK probably want to go on Snapchat, which the conservatives
do. Or elsewhere, basically WhatsApp or other alternative media spaces. But I think it's interesting also to point out that it's not there's not a single successful strategy that wins you an election. It always must be a combination of factors. So even if we talk a lot in this program about social media and the money spent and the targeting and the type of hashtags used and all that stuff, we don't want to say, I think, neither of us, that social media made or break this entire result. I think you have to see it in combination with everything. The message must be on point. So if you are very present on social media, you spend a lot of money, you target things, but your message doesn't resonate, well, you're not going to win. So yes, it's true that Labour had a very active presence on social media, and it's true that a lot of young people did support Labour, and it's true that a lot of young people are on social media. But the most interesting part was that Labour proposed to scrap tuition fees, which was one of the top issues for the 18 to 25-year-olds in the country. So without that message, this very intensive targeting would not have delivered the same result, I wanna say. The same with this connection between on and offline. You were saying about Snapchat and celebrities. Of course, Snapchat is a very nice medium to use and, in a sense, cement those connections. But Those celebrities also were present on television, saying the same positive things about Corbyn and about the Labour Party as on Snapchat. They were also very much on the ground, live in small places, giving free concerts, allowing Jeremy Corbyn to appear relaxed in the company of relatively famous British pop figures and so on and so forth. And only the combination, I believe, of these various campaign strategies turned out to be so successful. So isolating one aspect, I don't think is really useful in terms of explaining the success or failure of a specific party.
Yeah, I agree. And I think studies have shown that offline contacting, the traditional ground game, getting out on the streets, going door to door, that is the most effective form of persuasion and getting the message out. However, there's a caveat, which is for younger voters, online contacting by friends is extremely effective. So if, and it goes back to this idea of citizen mobilization, it's not so much that spamming a hashtag about Jeremy Corbyn is going to gain him votes. But if you're on Facebook and someone that you know and trust and someone whose opinion you respect and someone you're probably likely to run into in physical form
yeah,
is sharing certain news, that has a persuasive effect. So it is this, it's this combination of factors, both offline and online, but it's also a combination of factors, campaign-driven, Facebook advertising, but also what citizens are sharing, whether they're doing it concertedly, whether they're doing it on their own, what type of news are they sharing, what are the issues, what's the electoral system.
Everything must be factored in. And I think as researchers, sometimes we have the tendency to analytically isolate different segments in writing articles and extracting data and so on. But I think at least in the discussions that we're having in such formats, it's important to see how everything is connected and how we cannot isolate truly these phenomena from each other, which makes me actually happy in terms of the democratic consequences of using or integrating social media in campaigning. I think it's nothing to be worried about. There's some optimism actually connected to having social media as an outreach channel, both for parties, but also for citizen-initiated campaigns, to quote the title.
Yeah, and just as a lot of the digital directors say, it's about reaching voters where they are. And people are on social media through their phones more than they are picking up newspapers. So that is the effective medium. Is there anything else that
I think that was basically what I really wanted to say. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you about these very hot off the press results and about this strategic campaigning.
Yes, of course. Pleasure to have you on, as always. And head on over to our Facebook page, Social Media and Politics Podcast, where you'll find a live stream where we dig more into the ramifications and implications of this hung parliament, this unexpected election outcome in the UK elections. Like I said, I'm going to try to get this programmer who developed the Who Targets Me Chrome extension on the show. But as of now, our next episode is with Dr. Shelley Bouillon, who has done some really interesting research comparing the results of social media studies. So she did it's called a meta-analysis, first of 36 studies, then of 150. So we talk about the results of that and very much in line with what we've been talking about here in terms of social media and participation. So that's all the time we have for today. Swing by Twitter at SMNP Podcast. Check out the live stream on Facebook. I'm your host, Michael Vecetta, signing off from Lund, Sweden. See you next time.